I'd also like to take a moment to recognize some of the members of the Lichtenstein family who are with us. Rav Aaron's sisters, Shoshana Avner and Hadassah Klayman. And also, please permit me to convey the feelings of Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, Rav Aaron's wife, Admeya Ve'esrim, who is not here this evening, but very much wanted me to convey her sincerest appreciation to all who organized and planned this memorial, to her husband, and to thank everyone for coming. This is what she wrote to me before Shabbos. Please convey to the organizers and participants that I do find great comfort in the expression of love and respect for my husband that has enveloped me, my children and grandchildren these past weeks. It is most comforting to see and experience the impact that my husband Rav Aaron had on the Torah world here and in Chutz La'aretz. My best wishes to all, Tova Lichtenstein. At Rav Aaron's Levaya, each of his children delivered memorable eulogies. But it was Rav Moshe who began the Hespedim and who in pain grief began his Hesped with a plaintive cry. Quoting Tehillim, he painfully wailed again and again, Or Zerua Latzadik Ulayishre Lev Simcha. Or Zerua Latzadik Ulayishre Lev Simcha. His choice of this pasuk was self-evident. His father, both a tzaddik and a yashar, deserved no less a lament. Perhaps, though, there might be a deeper meaning behind this portrayal of Rav Aaron. In rabbinic literature, there's a machlokes rishonim, a disagreement between Rashi and Rashba, as to which characterization is superior, that of the tzaddik or that of the yashar. Could the nod go to the tzaddik, who battling forces of darkness and confusion emerges victorious and earns the ore of Torah in both scholarly depth and sweeping range? Or might our choice be the Yashar, who by dint of his sterling midot tovot towers over his charges and enjoys the simcha of knowing that he is loved and revered by all? About such a dispute, the Rav might have said, both are correct. At times the tzaddik outranks the yashar, and at other times the yashar dominates over the tzaddik. Clearly, both the tzaddik and the yashar are people who are universally admired and esteemed. But to find these two qualities in superlative excellence in one person, and more, to behold with astonishing awe how such a person can so seamlessly blend these two attributes together so that the Torah of the tzaddik and the ethics of the yashar are of one cloth, kula miksha achat zahav tahar, a person of pure gold, to find such a person is extraordinarily rare indeed. But bizos yavo aharon el hakodesh. It was with both these attributes of tzidkus and yashrus that our Rav Aaron Lichtenstein approached his sacred mission in life as a true Eved Hashem. Merachok Hashem nireli, cries Yirmiyo. It has been almost 2 months since Rav Aaron left us, and yet, even as his presence recedes and the distance widens, his image rises in our eyes and his great legacy looms ever larger with each passing day. In the words of the Navi, Torat emet hayita b'fiu v'avla lo nimtza b'sfatav b'shalom uv'mishar halach iti v'rabim heishiv me'avon. The teachings of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace, and with fairness and turned many away from iniquity. And it is this person, this Anav B'midot and Godol B'Torah, who we have all come to venerate this evening. The first of our speakers at this Azkara is Harav Moshe Lichtenstein, Rav Aaron's eldest. Many were present when Rav Moshe was invested as Rosh HaYeshiva at Yeshivat Har Etzion years ago. I recall the expression of pride and affection on Rav Aaron's face when he embraced and kissed his eldest son and danced with him. Rav Moshe brings both his father's and his own Torah scholarship to his teaching and leadership role at the yeshiva. He is passionately dedicated to his yeshiva and to his Talmidim. And for those of us who know him well, he is a wonderful and warm person, exhibiting all the many midot tovot of his dear parents. Rav Moshe.
So good evening, and I'd like to join Rabbi Bienenfeld thanking all those who organized it, and of course Rabbi Bienenfeld himself was the only person he omitted from his long list of thanks, and I appreciate everything he did. I know it was done as a mitzvah of Kvot Talmidei Chachamim and a deep personal connection, but nevertheless it is certainly appreciated. To be honest, I find it difficult standing here tonight. And since I feel in a crowd, which I feel close to many, many people here, and know many of them, I would like to allow myself to explain a bit. There have been many, many aspeidim in the past almost 2 months, from the Levaya itself, and the outpour of hesped and tanchumim was constant. Last Sunday I was in Askara, the Monday before I was in Askara, and so on and so forth. And at some point, you begin to feel that you've said enough. The feelings exhaust themselves. It's time to replenish your feelings. It's time to take a pause and to dive in again and go back to some kind of routine and to wait a few more months until enacting in Hesped. The Rabbi Bienenfeld convinced it was an evening of achievement and legacy and not necessarily Hesped, but that's not the reason I came. I'm not foolish enough to realize that this isn't a Hesped. The reason I came is very simple. I feel the act of Hesped is not only to register a historical record or to try to present a picture of a person. It's really the need to come together and to experience together. The pasuk tells about Eov that when the tragedy befell Eov, his companions came. For 7 days they sat together in the room, ve'ein dover lav davar. Nothing was said. So what were they doing for 7 days? They were simply expressing their empathy and solidarity by being in the room together with him. So Baruch Hashem, my father lived a long and productive and fruitful life. Baruch Hashem, he's not an EO figure, and we don't need that kind of comfort. But I feel that he was active in many, many different communities. We made a hesped 2 weeks ago in New York. Because my father was active in Israel, he was active in the United States, and it was appropriate to experience the hesped and to recollect the image and to re-experience the loss together with a large crowd who were part of his life. And I think my father also had a third community, not only those in Israel and those who were in America, but those who came from America to be in Israel. One of the Gemarot, he was very fond of quoting, is the Gemara in Ksuvas Dafayin Hay, that Chad Minan Kitre Minayu, I mean, the Gemara says as follows, that person who comes in Aliyah is worth two people who are born native. The reason being, he has a dual perspective. He has both the perspective of Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael. He sees things not only locally, but he also has a broader perspective because he's bringing with him his other world to the table. Secondly, because these people have also not only, they're not here because they, by circumstance, happen to be born here. They're here because they made a conscious decision to come here. My father, and this is, I think, an element which almost wasn't mentioned, he was a decisive person. He made many decisions in his life, all of which then played out and impacted deeply upon his life, whether it was to go to Harvard, whether it was to leave Chaim Berlin and go to YU, though, of course, I could say my grandmother probably was the more active force over there, and she was the one who steered down Rav Huttner Zatzal. But it was the decision to go to Harvard. It was the decision to come in Aliyah. It was the decision to go to Haritzion. He made many... He actually was a decisive person. He did not... once he made up his mind, he then followed it through. And the first day of the Shiva, Rebbetzin Amital came to Menachem Us. And, of course, my mother and she began reminiscing a bit about Gush Etzion in the early 70s. And at some point, Rebbetzin Amital said, look, you know, we came from nothing. You left the whole mamlach over there, and you came over here, because my mother said to him, we came, things are soft already. When you came before us, the hardship was much greater, which was true, though everything is relative. And Rebbetzin Amital said, no, but you left so much more behind you. So my mother said to her, come on, what do you think America is? It's not such a great, you know, the Olam Hazeh is not so great. It's not, you know, we weren't so enamored of America, and we lived in Washington Heights after all. To which Rebbetzin Amital said, you don't understand, I'm not talking about the material comfort. I'm talking about the fact that your husband was in a major yeshiva with a career path in front of him. He was the Rosh Kollel, he had a shir, he was in a major center. And my husband, Rav Mital, which is true, at the time, before he came to Eretz Yisrael, he was really, he was not in any major venue. You came and left something much greater, which, and I think it's absolutely true. My father really left behind him, one could say, a clear path to develop a very good career in Herbertus Torah in the U.S. He was decisive. And therefore, I think this community, as I began before, the community of people sitting here who came in Aliyah, to a large degree, was a third community in which he was very much engaged and involved in. And therefore, to a large degree, I came tonight to be part of this community and to re-experience and to feel the avilut amongst a group of people, which I really felt were part of his milieu and part of his chivra. Of course, also, there are many people here who knew him well before I was born and who knew him in the Rav Shir yet, and it's always part of the idea of Nechama is to really interact and to get a window into your father's life before you were able to be there. It's also part of the process of Nechama. Having said that, I will therefore direct my remarks, and I will preface by saying the following. To a certain degree, many of the spadim repeat themselves. You don't have to divide themselves. There were subtle differences, and there were different perspectives. I remarked to someone afterwards during the Shiva that even though someone said to me, well, you know, each child must be different, I said, it's true, but it's like looking at an exhibit in the museum, which you can walk around in a glass case, you can walk around the exhibit. Everyone's describing the same exhibit, the same object from a slightly different perspective. And I think, to a certain degree, it's true. Some people, it's very difficult to be maspid. They're enigmatic. They're they're twisted. They're somewhat convoluted. My father, in that regard, was very straightforward. He was steady. He was consistent. He's not a difficult person to be maspid in that regard. And especially, he was able to transmit his message and get his message across. In other words, he didn't... And he was a teacher, or a Rebbe, actually. Part of the act of education, certainly in the world that he was active in, is v'shinantam levanech elu talmidim, It's willing to let students into your world. It's willing to have them become part of your world. It means, in a sense, to give up some of your privacy. And because of that, I think he really got his message across. He indeed was familiar to many, many people. And so therefore, parts of what were said repeated themselves. I see it not as a disadvantage, but as an advantage. It's an advantage because al pi shnayim edim yakum davar. If you have one aid, if you have one person with a very unique perspective, you never know, is this the objective persona, or is this the objective truth? Or is this simply a very idiosyncratic and peculiar way of viewing things? Or to use a different phrase, is it platform dependent or not? When you have two people and you can then cross-examine and see what, if two people with different mindsets, with different perspectives, repeat the same idea, clearly what you're seeing is what's out over there. That's why halacha requires two edim, al pi shnayim edim yakum davar. That's also when two maspidim say the same thing, it just reinforces the conviction rather than just repeating and being stale. I think it reinforces the impact because you're saying things which indeed were so. So if I repeat things which were said, and I think it's very difficult after 50-something days to arrive at some unique or unknown or some hidden secret, I think it reinforces rather than weakens the point itself. Given the crowd tonight, I would like to focus primarily upon my father's impact in Eretz Yisrael. My mother went to the U.S. 2 weeks ago, as was mentioned, and there she tried to describe his impact in America from Israel. I will try to describe his impact in Israel from Israel. These are things which now are much more self-evident and obvious. My father eventually became consensus or mainstream, or at least more mainstream and more consensual. When he first came, he was considered quite radical and very much out of the mainstream. I'll begin with a very simple story. 1970, we came for a summer to test the waters, to try out Eretz Yisrael. We came for a summer to get acclimated to children, I think, to a large degree, to get used to Israeli kids and Israeli culture. My father was invited to speak at the Knesset Torah Shebaal Peh of Musar Rav Kook. And, excuse me, he was also invited to speak there, but the story I'm going to tell is he was invited to speak in Beit HaNasi. They made an evening in honor of Kol HaNevuah, the Sefer of the Nazir. The book is predicated upon a contrast between hearing and seeing, hearing being a much more inner sense, it enters into your body. Sight is described as artificial, superficial and external. Basically, he champions the idea of Kol HaNevuah, the voice, the inner voice, on the cheshbon of sight. My father took very much offense at that. He thought that the faculty of sight, of vision, was the critical faculty, and he spoke there, even though he was 30-something, he spoke there basically this evening in honor of the book. He basically spoke out against the whole thesis of the book and made it quite clear that his sentiments lay in other places. There were two Atkele Kach that Rav Gorin Zatzal, if I remember, tore up his remarks and just simply attacked my father, if I remember. After which another prominent Rav came over to him and said, leave him alone. He hasn't fasted the 40 fasts of Rav Zera that you have to fast when you come to Eretz Yisrael. He still has Trat Chutz La'aretz, and over time he'll fast 40 times and he will forget his Trat Chutz La'aretz and adapt Torah to Eretz Yisrael. That's how it was viewed at the time. What he has to do is forget everything. Or as we'd say now, he has to recalculate his route and he has to begin, he has to start to reset everything. And of course, that's how it was at the time. My father came and introduced into Eretz Yisrael, if you want, the voice of religious humanism. And I'll explain what I mean by this. There were others who had the same vision. There were others who were making the same points. However, at the time, earlier, I don't know, but at the time, most of those voices were coming from people who were from but outside the Torah world. In other words, they were not coming from Shei Yeshivot. They were coming from professors, from thinkers, but they were not rooted within the yeshiva milieu Right, so at the time, you had the Haredi world, which had its perspective, and you had Yeshivot Hesder, which were advocating an idea of Hesder B'di'evet, meaning essentially they were quasi-Haredi in some form or another. And you had the Merkaz Harav world, which is coming from a totally different perspective. And someone coming with someone quoting Crime and Punishment when he spoke about Parshas Toldos, or things of the like, were quite foreign and strange and, what should I say, piquant, or it was an oddity at the time. And this is the voice he used to, just to give it a... And now, it was not only... It was partially what he said, the whole vision of integrating universalistic approach, humanistic approach into Torah was perceived as quite there. I remember I spoke to Rav Mital one. Rav Mital used to speak in the yeshiva at the time in Sefer Breishis, excuse me. He would speak often about what really matters in Sefer Breishit is not the human drama. What really matters is the ideals, the Maaseh Avot, Siman LeBanim. It's the cosmic drama or the national drama being played out on the stage of the lives of the Avot. The Avot are vehicles to realize these great ideas. And Kal V'chomer, this is Rabbi Mital, Kal V'chomer, those who are another yeshivot, and my father would speak every other Shabbos about the human condition and the tragedy. It was always tragic. The tragedy of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the tragedy of Avraham Avinu, and the tragedy of Yaakov Avinu, and the tragedy of Yitzchak Avinu, and Nochweiter. It was always the tragedy of somebody, rather. But he would state time and time again, what matters is, yes, to re-experience what Avraham Avinu went through at the time is what this is all about. I simply want to try to explain and to lay forth what happened to Avraham Avinu, the same way a person cares about what happened to his elder Zayda because he happens to be his mishpacha. What happened to Avraham Avinu matters, A, because of that, B, it matters because the prototype of the way human life should be lived. And he would time and time again talk about the human drama. And 1 week, Rav Mital would talk about Masevot Siman LeBanim, and the other week, my father would talk about this. And this is part of what people talk about their partnership. It wasn't only that they the kavod or the power. It's they really came from different perspectives at the time. Over time, Rav Mital came closer, and it's part of what I'm trying to get across tonight. But this was the world he was living in at the time. The message of the humanistic message per se was an important and at the time it was a novel approach, or this was basically what he was getting across. It was seen as strange and this went together with the fact that he did not take for granted, let me put it differently, he was opposed to some of the nationalistic trends, which were very, very powerful at the time, the way they still are. I assume many of those sitting here have probably seen the letter that the Rav wrote, which is published in the volume of letters, Community Covenant, whatever it's called, Commitment Covenant Community, or something like that. And there's a letter the Rav wrote, we assume it's a draft, and it's translated, in the volume it's translated, the Hebrew original, the original was in Hebrew, in which he describes three approaches to the Medina, one of which thinks it has no religious value whatsoever, a second which thinks it's the end of everything, and a third which sees it as a utility, but a very valuable and meaningful one as such. And the Rev writes over there, Halacha le'olam k'da'a ha'shlishit. Lo k'da'at ha'sholulim, meaning the Haredim, ve'lo k'da'at ha'hozim, meaning Rav Kook. And this is the same. Now, the Rav sat in the States and spoke about it over there. My father was here in the trenches. I remember once he took a ride together with Hanan Paratzal. They ride together in a car, and Hanan at some point asked my father, what do you think about this? And he reads to him a passage, Hamedina hi ha'osher hayoter elyon, and continues, I can't quote the thing by heart, but it's a well-known passage in Rav Kook's Orot, and my father did not recognize it, which is part of where he's coming from. So Hanan says to him, what do you think about this statement, Hamedina hi ha'osher hayoter elyon? My father said to him, Zemezazea. I should, in fairness, add that Rav Kook tones it down a bit. If you read the whole passage, later on, he tones it down. He qualifies a bit. But nevertheless, Sadr Hanan says, well, you know, this is the source of the quote. My father says, besides, I still think so. I hope I'm not embellishing it too much, but the gist of the story certainly is true. I once spoke to him about a certain approach to Pesach and Gerus, and about some of the contemporary issues, but I won't get more specific than that. And he said to me, Tov, ha-gisha ha-lu'umit ma'avira otam al da'atam. That was throughout one of the, if anybody's ever heard Rav Yoel Ben-Nun be master my father, or speak about him in one of the occasions we had before the Patira, it always goes back to a single story. The story is, in 1973, Tzahal shot down a commercial jetliner over Sinai because they were afraid that it was a spy plane, and in the process killed about 160 civilians or something like that. And my father gave a scathing sicha on the yeshiva the next day about that, to which Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun then gave a counter sicha, but at the end of the day, I think Rabbi Yoel realized that eventually I think hodalo at the end, but what's more important is it was a perspective that he never occurred to him, because in the name of Bitchon HaMedina and the Le'umiyut and everything which we're doing to fortify Jewish security, anything goes. And the fact that there's a certain moral calculus which has to be attended to, Rabbi Yoel describes as being an eye-opener for him. And if that's said by one of the most sensitive and deep souls which emerged from that to milieu, kal v'chomer, about others. Now, this is the message he came out. I'll mention one other point. I once spoke to Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun about a certain person, certain figures in Gush Emunim, and I complained about the fact I felt at the time they were condoning violence towards Arabs, to which Rabbi Yoel said to me, no, there's a mitoch ahavat Eretz Yisrael. I said to him, Isur, whatever, you know, Isur p'giyah b'aravim, whatever, is kal b'nehem. He said to me, no, it's just Eretz Yisrael blinds them. I said, I don't believe that such a person, in order to reinforce our possession, in particular parts of Yehuda Shomron, would go into a restaurant and eat the velot and trefot just because he wants to say, Shesh kanochechut Yehudit. So Rabbi Yoel said to me, Atatoeh. I still don't think I was, but the fact that someone like that could say with a straight face, not that he would do it, but he believes that Ploni would do it, this tells you the kind of mindset that my father was up against at the time. That the person could say to me that, okay, people would eat nevelot in order levases tachiza ba'aretz. Now, against this he came totally in opposition. Eventually, I think things, as I said before, he became much more mainstream. Now, I'd like to add a second point in this regard. Part of it was the message, it was the quality of the messenger, was the depth of the message, was the inner conviction of the messenger. However, it was also something else. It was also went together with the institutional framework. When you wanted the message, it's not enough to go from symposium to symposium and get your message across. At the end of the day, people go and they go home and that's the end of that. If you really want to have an impact, you have to mold Talmidim. You have to be an institution, you have to impact upon people, day in, day out, day in, day out. You have to be an educator. At the end of the day, you build lives, and then, in a much more subtle and a much more permanent way, you go ahead and are able to impact upon them. I spoke in a previous aspect about Shelcha Gadol Mishelahem, that Aaron HaKohen is so frustrated that to see him bring these grand korbanot and these majestic offerings, and Aaron is left with something trivial, so to speak, and he's told, Shelcha Gadol Mishelahem. And I think the answer is, because why is Aaron's offering much greater? Because in the sea, it was one and off. They came, it was a grand gesture, it was a great ceremony, and they went home. By the way, I'll add parenthetically, one of the big enigmas, in my opinion, of Sefer Bamidbar, is what in the world happened to the Nesim. In the beginning of Bamidbar, you appoint the Nesi'im, you give them this great spotlight of Chanukas HaMishkan, and then when crisis after crisis hits home, meaning Kivras HaTaiva and the Meraglim, where are the Nesi'im? They've disappeared. The idea of Zkenim Nishmetu repeats itself a second time around, and why does Moshe Rabbeinu need 70 people in Parshas Baaloscha to all of a sudden to appoint? He already appointed 12 Nesi'im. They somehow dissolved somewhere along the way, apparently. And so they came, they did this great korban and disappear. Aaron comes day in, day out. And the korban, the menorah, machzita baboker, machzita baerev. You do it day in, day out. You light it, you clean it. You light it, you clean it. You're there all the time. And it's also done with a sense of mission. Aaron works with a sense of shlichut and sherut. And my father, even though he could have given a public lecture every evening and filled his days productively, he spent a massive amount of time in the yeshiva, a massive amount of time, following the tradition of the Netziv and the like, because he felt that the way to really impact upon people and to get his message really across was to mold souls day in, day out, and to have them at home on Shabbatot, and to speak in the yeshiva every other Shabbos, and so on and so forth. Institutional building is not easy. And the fact that Yeshivat Har Etzion, Baruch Hashem, is doing so well, even though both of its founders are no longer with us, is because both of them were masters not only at the messages, not only did they have a clear philosophy, but they also understood how you build an institution, how you instill institutional culture, how you're able to mold the institution in a way. When Yom HaTzmaut rolls around, I have to begin to reinvent the wheel and to think, how should we go about celebrating Yom HaTzmaut? We know there's already institutional culture in place. So obviously it's evolving. Obviously it's not stratified. It's evolving. But the basic ideas, the origins where I begin, is of course from Yom Kippur, because my father did the Sefer Torah of Yom Kippur, and there's a whole institutional culture which they both instilled about when do you have shiurim, how do you have shiurim, and so on and so forth. And all of this was the platform for which he was able to impact upon society so much. At the Shloshim, we had an event in Yeshiva, Rav Ariel from Ramadiyam was Maspid, and he came and spoke. He spoke with my father very warmly, but amongst other things, he began to say, well, you know, I also studied literature in high school, and we were in high school once upon a time, so we used to say literature, and he read, so I forget the poets that he quoted, I think Byron, if I remember, and a few others, who's, of course, he said, Karanu shir echad mikol echad kamuvan, lo, but in a sense, it was, someone said to me afterwards, in a sense, this was the Kan Hodalo ala Brachot. In other words, Kan, the world, my father came and he was perceived as such an outsider and a stranger 40 years ago, came basically to be maspik him and to say that not only was he a big Talmid Chacham, not only could he give a good Shir Kali and the like, but also he brought a rich world and was able to instill it here in Eretz Yisrael. And the world, to put it differently, the world of the Yachid and the focus upon the Yachid and the focus upon complexity served and still serve a crucial need. And everything is upon the collective. I went a few years ago to a meeting of Rabbanim and educators, and one of them said, quite perceptively, we put so much emphasis upon the tzibur, at some point we forgot the yachid. And now there's a counter-reaction, because we forgot for 30 years, we forgot the yachid, we neglected the yachid, and now a good deal of self-expression and the like is because we gave a not properly balanced diet at the time. And at the time, I really feel my father was the person who was balancing, was trying to balance at least, by focusing on the individual and following force in the Rav's footsteps. And the Rav was in the States, and the Rav was known here only through his writings. And my father, as I said before, was in the trenches educating. And this brings me to two final points. Number one, my father, one of his contributions to the world of Tzilut Datit was articulating an ideology of Hesder. And I'd like to explain why he was the person who could do it. It's very paradoxical. you would assume, presumably, it should have been done by someone who was much more gung-ho army, much more the America's Harav people. There was only this American Olech Hadash had to come and articulate the vision of a Hesder. Seemingly very strange. It seems to me, I think the reason is quite simple. Zotrat HaHesder was out to establish the ideology of Hesder, not vis-a-vis those who want to do 3 years army, but vis-a-vis those who thought you should be doing the army at all. That was the issue 40 years ago. Now the issue is different. My father remarked it 2-3 years ago. It's time to write a new article, Mishnat HaHesder, I guess you should call it, which will explain why to do Hesder and not 3 years in the army. But at the time, that wasn't the issue. The issue was, why do Hesder and not go to Yeshiva Gvoha? Now, I think my father, those who came with very strongly nationalistic perception, they didn't have to explain the importance of the army. It was self-evident. So they didn't feel a need to write such an article. It was simply, if you write the Hamadina Usher Yoter Elyon, there's nothing to write an article. It's an axiomatic truth. It's your mother's milk. So like a father who's coming, in a sense, from a very similar place in which the Medina is a tool and the like, and Jewish history is important, but at the end of the day, Avodat Hashem is ahistorical because Kadosh Baruch Hu is above time and is eternal. So he could appreciate the question and the need to answer it. So he was able to answer it, was able to appreciate the question. If it's too self-evident to you, you can't do that. So Dafka coming with the perspective of religious humanism, he was able to articulate properly the ideology of the Hesder. Coming from a Umiyut perspective, there was nothing to articulate. It was simply axiomatic. And the second point is, my father wrote often, and it's published in Leaves of Faith, but his expectations for modern orthodoxy. And he came here with a vision, instead of a religious humanism. The modern orthodoxy can exist in one of two formulas. It can exist, what I would call, from a position of weakness. It's like this follows. Modernity is a given. We want a modern lifestyle. We want gadgets. We want leisure. And we want to be part of the popular culture. Modernity is a given. The only question now is, do you go to the movies or the theater with a kippah or without a kippah? Now, if you go to the movies, that's axiomatic. But more differently, I will certainly be modern. And you cannot deny modernity is where I am. And you cannot deny that from me. Therefore, provide me now with the proper framework that can be orthodox. You come from a position of weakness. Your position, because in a sense, you're prioritizing something else. However, now, it's crucially important to be able to provide such an answer to people as such. In that regard, modern orthodoxy is not so much an ideology, it's rather a historical response. It's really a historical movement, not an ideological movement. And I think it did amazing zchuyot it has to be able to provide for such people the ability to remain from, even though they knew what they needed. That's modern orthodoxy position of weakness. This modern orthodoxy position of strength, in which you believe that general culture has what to offer, that fusing the two together, integrating them, is able to provide added depth, is able to provide greater spirituality. It was the model of the Rav, if you want. You can produce a Rav only by combining the best of both worlds. And that's modern orthodoxy from a position of strength. You believe the sum is greater than each part. By putting together both human knowledge, general culture, and Torah, you're able to create a much greater and a much deeper Avodat Hashem. My father would often say as follows. Modern orthodoxy, or centrist orthodoxy, whatever you want, pays certain inherent prices. The very fact that you adopt a dialectical approach to life, that you recognize a certain complexity and a certain amount of conflicting values, there are inherent prices. To start from the trivial, time. And of course, it's not only time, there are much more basic tensions involved in this. Some prizes are therefore inherent. And those, if you've decided that this is the world for you, you pay them knowingly. You pay them because you know that's the prize to achieve. It's Yiridat Tzorech Aliyah if you want. You pay such a prize in order to achieve a greater goal. However, the other prices, which are not necessary, they're not inherent in the system. They're paid because we're careless, because we lack enough spiritual attention. And he wrote about this in Leaves of Faith. He would speak about this often, that he felt there's a lack of passion. Particularly about tefillah, he felt that tefillah did always reflect there's certain inherent tension, maybe, with philosophical sophistication and tefillah. But that's what he was talking about. He was talking about simply laziness, simply spiritual lethargy. The loss of passion, intensity, that he often, what would drive him crazy, he used to give shir in the yeshiva, he would see school children going home at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, since that he felt was a price, which is totally unnecessary. There was the fact that you're modern Orthodox doesn't mean kids have to go home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and when they're the second, third graders and the like. And it was this what he really wanted. I think his one legacy, which he really leaves us, is the last chapter there of the second volume, Leaves of Faith, how to make the modern orthodoxy or the religious humanism to come from a position of strength, to come with the passion, with the intensity, with the commitment that it causes you not to do less, but to do more. Not to be less engaged, to be doubly engaged. And if he came here, his approach was suspect at the time that maybe it causes people to be less orthodox and more modern. I think that this challenge faces Tzionut Datit or the modern orthodox community in Israel to this very day. Do you? My daughter was in Bnei Akiva. She began when she was in fourth grade. So they had a tiyul on Sukkot. So I called up and I asked, this is from 15 years ago, I think it's better now. I called up the local person in charge of I said, what is your kashrus policy? Like, since you're providing the food, what's the kashrus policy? So I had this long, long silence. I felt that I asked them, what is Bnei Akiva's policy about nuclear disarmament? It would have been a more intelligent question. And finally, she says to me, "Anachnu konim b'makolet," and that's the policy. Konim b'makolet. So it's true that makolet is a hechsher. It's also, I said, "Well, what do you do about basar chalak? Yes or no? Sfaradim can't eat basar lo chalak. What do you do about chalav akum? Do you have any policy?" So now, she was 17 years old. I never complained about her, but I felt that I quoted this story many, many times in Shivat Haaretzion. And in Purim already they make fun of me about this story. A month ago, I went to a prominent family in a well-known modern Orthodox community in Gush Dan, and we were there for a Shabbos and a family simcha. And they asked the host, who's a professor in a prestigious university. I said to her, "I'm a basar chalak." She looks at me this astounded look, and after about a minute or two, she says to me, "Ata makpid al chalak." If I told her that, you know, that I needed some kind of exotic fruit from the Philippines, it would have been she would have been less surprised. I said, "Ani mishtadel." And so she says to me, quote, "Anachnu konim basupercell." So the whole difference is over 20 years, from the makol, we've been upgraded to a supercell. But I think this is my father, one of the famous stories which he told, I was there. We came in the first year, in the first, second year Aliyah, very close to this shul, a few streets from here. We were driving down the street, and there's this car stuck, his tender stuck in the middle of the road, and there were these two kids, the driver was stuck, he was stopping up traffic. My father got out to help him push his truck. Then he asked these Ingelach who were playing over there in Yiddish, "Why didn't you push the truck? There's a mitzvah d'oraisa prigotina." So they looked at him and said, "He's ain't osa masa amcha." So he said, "How do you know?" And the Grand Pesachim says, "You're potter." So he says, "Well, how do you know?" He says, Mistam, he's not mafish trumas and maestros. And my father then wrote to the Rav, and he quoted this often. It's a famous story that he assumes that had this happened in a Tzioni Dati neighborhood, the kids would probably have not fulfilled the Gemara Pesachim, but they probably, intuitively, from human sentiment, would have helped him with push the truck, which was stuck. And then he wrote to the Rav, sort of lamenting the situation, why can't we produce children who both know the Gemara and are nevertheless willing to help even a person who doesn't have a kippah? Now, the Haredi world has its issues, but I feel that, you know, I've often heard this story told over by Talmidim, my fathers, and I always feel they don't get the point. Because they always tell the story about the second half, meaning, look how beautiful it is that you push the truck, even though it's all intuition. But I think the part that we should be looking in the mirror is not that part. The part we should look in the mirror is, well, why do we know the Gemara Pesachim? And why don't we? My father would always complain. He wanted he was makpid on a brisker chumrah for parashas of tefillin, that it should be without a tanai. And that the ibud lishma should be without a tanai. I won't explain the issue at the moment. And he had to rent a Bnei Brak for that. He said to me, how come you want a special heed, but you have to rent a Bnei Brak? How come you can't get it not in Bnei Brak? And that, at the end of the day, this issue remained and remains with us. And we should go back to that story and not only feel superior that we push trucks, even though we know the people are not osa masa hamcha, but ask ourselves that we should really make sure that our kids know the Gemaras as well and are aware of all the issues. So I think he leaves us not with a challenge and not only with a great accomplishment, a great achievement. I really think he was able to impact upon Israeli society greatly. But I also think that we should go. It's now time not to introduce the religious humanism into a siyach Israeli, but it's rather time to begin investigating what are the prices of this and how can we best avoid these pitfalls and make it more intense and more passionate, because now that we have a modern Orthodox society in Eretz Israel, not only a Tzion Lidati society, it's time to make sure that modern Orthodoxy is just as intense, just as passionate as he was, and that's he aspired for all of us to be. Toda Rabbah.
Thank you very much, Rav Moshe. Our next speaker is Rabbi Dr. Daniel Tropper. Rabbi Tropper has and still plays a major role in education in Israel. As many of you know, he founded Gesher, a unique organization in this country, and many other educational initiatives. He was a former advisor to the Minister of Education, has played many, many roles in the state. He also was a founder of the Meimad Party along with Rav Amital Zatzal and the architect of the revival of the Bayit Yehudi Party in the last few years. Rabbi Tropper Danny is known, Rav Aaron, for close to 60 years, first by davening in the same shul in their youth and later as a neighbor for 30 years. He will address Rav Aaron, the personal side of a gadol. Danny.
I've had the great privilege of being close to Rav Aaron Zatzal for many years, and I also have a deep sense of debt because of the important role that he has played in many of the personal issues in my life and in almost everything that I've done professionally in Israel. I wish to share with you tonight some of those stories that I am at liberty to tell. And I think we can get an interesting picture of this very special person. Rav Aaron, we all know, was a very humble person. He had true humility. But to understand this humility, you'd really need a triangle, because it's humility, authenticity, and Yirat Hashem. Those three worked together to produce a very unusual kind of person. Rav Aaron lived around the corner from me, and down the block lived the Rav of the neighborhood, Harav Eliezrov, Zichrono Vracha. He was a great Talmud Chacham, wrote some very important shuvos. And when Rav Eliezer was an old man, he broke his hip. He started a minyan in his home. Rav Aaron davened there every morning. I was the gabbai. My job was to make sure there was another eight people there. Now, Rav Aaron was a great Talmud Chacham, but Rav Eliezer didn't, at the beginning, have any idea of the range of this man's knowledge of Torah. I remember I came in one Friday before Shabbos, Erev Shabbos. I used to like to come to him after we lit candles, talk to him a little bit. And I had with me a new sefer that was just put out by the yeshiva. It's Talmidim, wrote up a shiurim. So the Rav asked me, what book do you have? I said, Rabbi Lichtenstein just published a new book. He said, ooh, let me see it. He opens it up. And he looks at it and looks up to me and says, Taharos? Chidushim al Taharot? A man, Rav Eliezer then, I think, first discovered that the range of Rav Aaron was all Shishay Sidrei Mishnah and in depth, besides Midrashim and everything, the whole Torah, Kol HaTorah Kula. People didn't know this about him. He had a humility that hid the true range and depth of his knowledge. His humility also hid a certain tzidkus that he had. I remember one Motzei Tisha B'Av, we left shul, and of course we went outside, we said, Kiddush Levana. Everyone was about to go home, and then I saw the Rav was first coming out with his cane till he got out. I said, hold up, the Rav is going to want to say Kaddish, I need 10 people to stay here. Rav Aaron looks around, counts there are 10, turns around and goes home. So I cynically say to his son Meir, who was standing next to me, I said, Meir, what's wrong with your father? What's he running? He's hungry? He says, no, you don't know what my father does not say Tisha B'Av? I said, what does he do? He sits and learns for an hour. He says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what do you think I missed on Tisha B'Av? Coca-Cola? I missed learning. First he learns, and then he eats. No one would know this about him. There's this man just counting people, turning around and walking away, not wanting anyone to know what he's really about to do at this moment. This is the kind of story you'd hear only about a Chafetz Chaim. Another thing, when I was Menachem Avel, I discovered something that there was no way I could know before that. It was a state secret of the Lichtenstein home. Tzitzis Rav Aaron a few years ago arrived at a decision that he should observe Chadosh, even for Chutz Laretz. I don't want to, the issue was a complicated one. But he felt that since the minhag wasn't accepted, it would be yuhara for him to accept this minhag. But he felt he had to accept it. And so he kept Chadosh in his house, but no one was allowed to tell. The house was sworn to secrecy, so no one should suspect that he is putting himself above other people. It was interesting, something else. After Rav Eliezer passed away, I met Tova, his wife, on the street, and I mentioned, I said, Tova, you know, Rav Aaron took Rav Eliezer's passing very, it was very difficult for him. Why? She said to me, look, when we were in America, she said to me, Aaron had the Rav and Rav Hutner above him. When he came to Israel, he was very close to Rav Shlomo Zalman above him. When Rav Shlomo Zalman passed away, he regarded Rav Eliezer as kind of the senior person. He was, you know, 15, 20 years old. He was the old man, the old Talmud Chacham. But when Rav Eliezer died, he felt, you can call it alone or uncomfortably on the top. And this was difficult for a man with the humility of a Rav Aaron. Now, Rav Aaron Rav's humility was also one that he had an utter disdain for anything that was spurious. It had to be real, it had to be authentic. Something very interesting, I just want to quote you from an article of his, just to give you an idea of how the man functioned. Rav Aaron has an article where he discusses, is there a ethic beyond halacha? Is halacha all-inclusive, or is there an ethic beyond it? And he phrases the question, essentially then, the question is whether halacha itself is self-sufficient. Its comprehensiveness and sufficiency are notions many of us cherish in our more pietistic or publicistic moments. Yes, it's a very nice thing to say hafochba, hafochba, the kulaba, when we're either pietist or a publicist moment. You know, when as rabbis, you know, when we're giving that sermon, it's a wonderful thing to say hafochba, hafochba, the kulaba. But Rav Aaron goes on to say, if, however, we mean that everything can be looked up, every moral dilemma resolved by reference to code or canon, the notion is both palpably naive and patently false. Rav Aaron did not play to the crowds. He was an authentic person, a real person. And this was in his humility. And now I wanted to share with you something. You'll see what another true humility really is. A true humble person is not a person that walks around saying, I'm nothing, I'm a nothing, I'm nothing. Moshe Rabbeinu knew he was Moshe Rabbeinu. And every human being needs recognition. But to know who you are, need recognition and still remain humble, this is the greatness. Last year, Rav Aaron received Pras Yisrael, the Israel Prize, for Talmudic literature. This was a very meaningful event for him. I think it was the day after he received the prize, he met with the Rabbeim and the Yeshiva, and he told them the following story. He told the story about one of the great Bali Musar, who once said, when I go into Beis Medrash and the boys stand up for me, I feel uncomfortable because I know who I really am. But if they didn't stand up, I'd feel worse. Now, Rav Aaron himself told us, this is true humility, a person that understands he needs recognition but remains humble through it all. The next thing I want to discuss is Rav Aaron's had a very unusual shikul hadas and balance in terms of bein adam lachaveiro. It's interesting. If we ask any of us, is bein adam lachaveiro important? Oh, yes, very important. And everything. And it's great sermon material. Great sermon material. But is it really authentically part of our life? Rav Aaron's life, it was. It was authentic. Someone told me, a friend of mine, that when he came to learn in Yeshivat Har Etzion, 25 years ago or so, as a new student, he wanted to approach Rav Aaron, but Rav Aaron was not always a very approachable person. Even though he was warm, he was open, it was just that way. And so he looked for something. Finally, he received from his parents one of those machines that copies tapes, duplicates tapes. Those are the days of tapes. This is an audience that still remembers what they were. Tapes, and he duplicated them. So he goes over to Rav Aaron and he says, I have this machine that duplicates tapes. Am I allowed to duplicate tape or is it Geneva? He said, Rav Aaron answered me, well, it's your tape. You could do with it whatever you want. But a medal for Gedoshim to you, you won't get an Olam Haba. This was his way of functioning. By the way, this is following the article that I previously mentioned. But this is real. This is the way he felt. This is the way he acted. I'll tell you another interesting story. A few years ago on the bus to Tel Aviv, I sat next to Bobby Hartman, the wife of the late Professor David Hartman, Abba Shalom. And Bobby told me that Rav Aaron and David Hartman learned by the Rav at the same time, and when David and she were married. They were young couples. They invited Rav Aaron, who was a single person and fellow, to come and eat by them one evening. Fine. She was a new vaibala. She was a new wife. She really didn't have control over cooking. She never cooked in her life. And in the dessert, by mistake, instead of putting in 2 tablespoons of sugar, she put in 2 tablespoons of salt. Happens. So the dessert is served. She says, David takes a piece, looks at me. I was ready to die. I didn't know what it was. I tasted it. I couldn't believe it. But Rav Aaron ate the entire thing. Rav Aaron would not insult the hostess. And so he ate it. This was Rav Aaron, a person who lived Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And if you want to have a living example of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, you really had to see that special relationship between Rav Aaron and Rav Amital. It was a legend. 2 Rosh Yeshivas. Equal. Totally equal. Absolutely different in every way. With deep respect, with deep love for one another. And never did Rav Aaron or Rav Amital have any feeling of competition. This was a living example of what respect for another person means. There's one other story, maybe if I have time at the end, I'll tell it, that has to do with this also. It's interesting that Rav Moshe, in his words, spoke about his father being very decisive. His image was not that way. Many people felt that he was wishy-washy. Basically, he was a person that, since he was so soft-spoken and so moderate, people misconstrued this as weakness and indecisiveness, but it wasn't true. The point is, Rav Aaron had a combination of being a deep thinker and integrity, and this led him to see complexity in every situation. He would see a situation in its broadest range. And once you see something that way, there are different sides to it. And therefore, this was misunderstood to be indecisiveness. But Rav Aaron was a man of courage and decision. Rav Moshe mentioned before the Aliyah. You have to understand what the Aliyah meant. I just want to reinforce, Rav Moshe, what you said. I mean, Rav Aaron was the heir apparent in Yeshiva University to the Rav. He gave up the dignity of a university for, in the 1970s when he visited, I ran the first Geshe seminars there. These were tin shacks. I mean, when he came, it was fancy. He gave up the splendor of Lamport Auditorium, for those that remember it, for prefabs. This was a person that had the courage to make a decision. It wasn't like, I came on Aliyah, I didn't give up anything. He gave up something very, very big. And his political position, which Moshe also mentioned. Here also, there was courage, and people, again, misunderstood him completely. Rav Aaron was regarded as a leftist. He wasn't a leftist. It wasn't, people didn't understand it. I'll just tell you a brief story that'll show you what a person of complexity, how he sees things. Before Ehud Barak left to Camp David to negotiate, sometime in the 90s, I think, maybe early 2000s, I don't know what year, he went to negotiate with Arafat. He was attacked bitterly by the religious Zionist as giving up, sellout, etc. And we felt that it was important that he hear a different voice. And so at 6 in the evening before he left on the 1 o'clock flight that night, 6 Rabbanim met with Ehud Barak in his office. I was one of them. It was very meaningful to Barak to meet with Rabbanim that came to give him a bracha before he left. After he said a few words, he asked us to respond. All eyes turned to Rav Aaron. 6 people in the room, including Rav Amital, everyone looked to Rav Aaron. I remember Rav Aaron spoke for about 4 or 5 minutes, that's all. He began by telling him the historic mission he is on. He is on a mission to achieve peace. Peace is the most important value. And he stressed that you can't get peace unless you make sacrifices. The two go together. You can't have a naive position to think we're going to get peace without sacrifices. And if you have to, we give you your bracha to make them. But, he said, you also have a historic responsibility to the Jewish people and the Jewish land. Remember what happened on every piece of this land, the history that unfolded. The Tanakh, the people that gave up their lives, the many battles. You have a responsibility for this land also. And you have to weigh the two and balance the two. And we give you a bracha that you should make the right decision. This was Rav Aaron, a man of balance, a man of integrity and complexity. And he was a man of great firmness also. I once had an incident in my shul. I'm not going to go into details. It's a very long story. But I was gabbai during the weekdays for Rav Eliezer. And on Shabbos, I switched my garments and became a rav in a shul. All right? And I had the shul for 35 years, a very distinguished shul. And we had a problem. For about 15 years, there were all kind of anonymous letters and all kind of written against one of our members. And it was a source of great anguish and embarrassment for this man. And it caused great consternation in the shul. I spoke 3 or 4 times about it. We also had something very few of you have seen, an ikuf tefillah. One day someone stopped the davening and demanded tzedek, this can't go on. Now, the letters were obviously sent by someone that had a deep sense of Kedusha and was concerned by Kedusha of Beit HaKnesset, but you just couldn't do it this way. Finally, we found the person. Now, this person was just not a regular person. He gave one of the major shiurim in shul. He played a central role in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And I knew this could split the shul. So I called together an ad hoc committee of all the past presidents and told them this person must go. He cannot give any more shiurim in shul, etc. They were with me, but there was one of the past presidents that was very sensitive to the perpetrator's plight from a human point of view, and he was right from a human point of view. And he said, we can't do this without asking Das Torah. Now, Das Torah in my congregation is like a Kohen Bebeit HaKvarot. I mean, he wanted Das Torah. And so I said, is Rav Lichtenstein good? Yes. So I called up Rav Aaron. I said, Rav Aaron, I don't usually ask you this, but I need you, and I need you right now. I'm here with 6 other people. I want to come over to your home now. So Rav Aaron said, come. We come, and I tell him the story. And they're all sitting around, and Rav Aaron, without hesitation, responds as follows. He says, let's say you were walking on Rehov Yafo, and you passed by a restaurant, a Trefa restaurant, and you look in the window, and there you see your Magid Shir, your central person on Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah, eating pork. Can he give the Shir? Everyone says, no, obviously not. And then he looked with a sense of anger and aghast at everyone. I don't understand you. If he eats pork, he can't give a Shir. But if he's Malbin Pnei Chaveiro Barabim 15 years, he can give a shir. It was amazing. His sense of perspective. I also learned the Gemara, Malbin Pnei Chaveiro Ein Lo Chelek L'Olam Haba, and it's like Rotzeach and everything. But for me, it was a drasha. For him, it was a real part of life. And he was so firm and so conclusive. And then he said also, and what about Chinuch? If you allow this man to keep teaching Torah, what are you saying to your children? This is the kind of man that we're dealing with. Maybe I'll end by just one more thing to show the strength and the uniqueness of a person who really was a leader, our leader. In 2011, Rav Aaron gave a shiur on Das Torah. It was printed in Hebrew. I don't believe it was ever translated in English. I don't know if it was ever printed even in a book, but it was circulated. All right. Rav Aaron there tells that he was being Menachem Avil Rav Hutna when his wife passed away, and they were alone, and Rav Hutna was very upset. Seems that before Rav Aaron, another Talmud, who was a great Talmud Chacham, came to visit him. And anyone that sat Shiva knows, some people say very stupid things, unfortunately. And Rav Hutna was very upset, and he quoted the Medrash, which says, all right, let me get that Medrash. Wrong one. There it is. All right. Kol Talmud Chacham she'ein bo das, nevela tova mimenu. Kol Talmud Chacham she'ein lo dat, nevela tova mimenu. For here he goes on to say, Das Torah means, besides Torah, the one you need Das. And he outlines three items that you need in Das. I'm not going to read them all to you. One, you have to understand the individual standing before you asking the question. You have to understand the person in depth. You have to understand human nature. Two, you have to understand the situation, the reality you're dealing with. And number three, the person answering has to make a judgment whether he is sufficiently knowledgeable in the area to give an answer. Only then does the answer have any value. And now I quote English translation of what he says about each three things. Greatness in Torah is no guarantee of interpersonal abilities, attentiveness, and sensitivity to the soul of the other person. Can one obey someone whose human dimension, sensitivity, and understanding of the human being is lacking? And in terms of understanding the reality of the situation, he says, and can one completely trust the Talmud Chacham, who is a giant in Torah, but lacking in Dat? And regarding being sufficiently knowledgeable to answer the question, he writes, he says, I am highly doubtful if one can take into account the Dat Torah of a rabbi and Talmud Chacham, great as he may be, who lacks the integrity and honesty to say, I do not know, or who is unable to utter the sentence, I am not knowledgeable and I am not familiar with this area. This was Rav Aaron. Strength, courage, integrity. I sometimes feel we don't even realize what we have lost. I can just end by telling you that I opened the hesped I gave for Rav Aaron in Beit Shemesh by saying, Rav Aaron was very important in my life, but he also made my life very difficult. He made my life difficult because being involved in chinuch and politics and various things, you very often walk on certain borders. It's difficult to know whether you're on the right side or the wrong side. And my wife, Fagi, would always ask me in these moments, would Rav Aaron do that? And that was devastating. And maybe that's what we have to take with us. Maybe we have to learn from the greatness of this man to make him a kind of standard in our life for our behavior before HaKadosh Baruch Hu and with our fellow man. Yehi Zichro Baruch.
Our third and final speaker, Rabbi Dr. Dov Frimmer. Professor Frimmer is a senior partner in the Jerusalem law firm of Frimmer, Gelman & Company and teaches family law and succession at the law faculty of the Hebrew University in Yerushalayim. He is a member of both the Israeli Bar and the New York Bar, serving as chairman of the Jerusalem Bar Association's Committee on the Court of Family Matters and the Rabbinical Court. An internationally recognized authority in Israeli and Jewish family law, Rabbi Frimmer has given expert testimony in these fields in courts around the world and has authored and edited numerous articles and books in the areas of family law and Jewish law, consultant to the Supreme Court here in Israel, a very special person. Rabbi Frimmer has been a Talmid of Rav Aaron and a close personal friend of the Lichtenstein family for 45 years. He will address Rav Aaron as a posek. Dov.
Over the last 2 months, since the passing of Moreno Rabbeinu, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, I, like most of you, have listened to and read tens of hespedim concerning Rebbe. Yet almost none of these hespedim addressed Rebbe as a posek. This is not surprising, since Rebbe refrained from paskening at Yeshivat Har Etzion. Nonetheless, for some 40 years, I and my entire family would turn to Rebbe with our halachic queries, from simple shilas in matters of Shabbos and Kashrus to more complex issues such as my halachic permissibility of my candidacy to serve as an Israeli Supreme Court justice, or connecting my mother, Aleha Shalom, to a life support system. Moreover, Rebbe was written into my law firm's partnership agreement to be the final arbiter on all halachic matters concerning the practice. Rebbe and I are third cousins, or as he would say, close enough to be mishpacha, but far enough to be kosher le'edus. Our parents were in ongoing contact. However, my relationship with Rebbe began only in 1969 when I attended his shiur at Yeshiva University. The Lichtensteins made Aliyah in 1971. However, when I came to Israel in 1973 to attend Bar Ilan Law School, I would regularly invite myself over to the Lichtenstein home at 2 Yordei Hasira Street in Katamon for Shabbos. Their hospitality, their warmth, their deep sensitivity was critical to my successful transition from the United States to Israel. And of course, it afforded me the opportunity to bombard Rebbe with my questions. When people would ask me how I described Rebbe as a posek, as opposed to other Rabbonim, I would respond, when I ask a shaila of other Rabbonim, recognized and respectable poskim, I know that they will give me a correct psak. However, when I ask Rebbe a shaila, I know that he will give me a true psak. Rebbe's tshuvas were always analytically profound, architectonically structured, and personally enriching. Needless to say, it is impossible in the few minutes allotted to me to treat all of the multifaceted dimensions of Rebbe's halachic methodology. I would, though, like to touch on what I consider to be two signature characteristics. The first is the educational quality of his psak, and the second, the humanistic quality of his rulings. But before we look at Rebbe's psak, I think it would be instructive for us to take a look at whom Rebbe himself would turn to for Piske Halacha. Before the Lichtensteins made Aliyah, Rebbe would naturally turn to the Rav Zatzal in halachic matters. However, since coming to Israel, Rebbe would turn to the esteemed Israeli halachic authority, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach of blessed memory. There is a famous story concerning Rebbe's daughter, Toni Lichtenstein Middleman, who at the age of 13 years old wanted to have her ears pierced. Rebbe, however, objected on halachic grounds. Toni, unconvinced, suggested that the two turn to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach for a ruling that would bind them both. Rebbe readily agreed. Upon presenting the issue before the great posek, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach immediately sided with Toni. Sometime after the event, I asked Rebbe as to the rationale for his objecting to the ear piercing and why Rav Shlomo Zalman nonetheless saw fit to permit it. I then proceeded to ask Rebbe why he turned to Rav Shlomo Zalman at all for psak. After all, the methodologies of learning were so dramatically different. Rebbe responded that before leaving the United States, he asked the Rav whom in Israel should he turn to on halachic matters. The Rav suggested Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rebbe then added, the Rav trusted Rav Shlomo Zalman's intellectual integrity. In addition to prerequisite of vast knowledge, it was the element of intellectual integrity which Rebbe repeatedly emphasized when discussing the credentials of a true posek. I would now like to focus on the first of the two signature characteristics of Rebbe's psak, which I highlighted above, the educational quality. Indeed, Rebbe was not known as a posek, and this was primarily due to the fact that he refrained from paskening in the yeshiva. Rebbe, that I would like to ask him a shaila. I do not recall the specific issue, but I clearly recall that in presenting the question, I forcefully argued to one particular result. At that point, Rebbe's wife, Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, one of the wisest women I know, critically remarked, Dov, are you interested in a psak or are you interested in a haskama? Rebbe quickly came to my defense, explaining how until the contemporary period, the questioner would clearly articulate a position and the respondent would need to grapple with the arguments presented. He lamented that the custom today of simply asking one-line questions such as, what bracha does one make over Kellogg's cornflakes, leaves the questioner uninvested, both intellectually and spiritually, in the halachic process. The multidimensional educational message of Rebbe agreeing to go with his daughter Toni to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach for halachic determination on ear piercing is obvious to all. I would like to share with you, however, an additional personal story which spans over a period of almost 25 years and clearly underscores Rebbe's emphasis on the educational component in psak. Like many young couples, when Shelley and I were married in 1975, we discussed whether or not she can go with her hair uncovered in my parents' home and in the home of my in-laws. I went to Rebbe, and he asked me why I thought it would be permitted. I cited the relevant text from the Masechet Ketubot, which in my view settled the issue. He thought for a moment and responded, "That's reasonable. I went home feeling very proud of myself that Rebbe accepted my contention that it was permitted for Shelley to go with her hair uncovered in our respective parents' home. 4 years later, I was writing my doctoral thesis on the topic of Overt al Dat Yehudit as grounds for divorce, a topic which includes treatment of women going with their heads uncovered. Needless to say, I was eager to include in my doctoral thesis Rebbe's ruling on the matter. So I diligently wrote it up, took it over to his house for review and approval. Rebbe carefully read what I had drafted and said, "No, no, no." "What do you mean, no, no, no?" I retorted. Rebbe proceeded to explain that what I had drafted was my understanding of the sugya, which he had acknowledged was reasonable. But now I wanted to cite this as in his name. That I could not do, because he was not convinced that I was correct. Obviously frustrated, I explained to Rebbe that I now have two problems. The first is what to do about this chapter in my doctoral thesis. The second is what Shelley should do now. After all, up until now, she had been uncovering her hair in the homes of our parents, and of my parents and her parents, on the assumption, an apparently incorrect assumption, that this was Rebbe's psak. Now that we know that this is not the case, what should Shelley do lemaisa? As for the first problem, Rebbe suggested that we discuss our respective positions further and then together draft the salient points of our differing views, which we did. And that is how it appears in my published doctoral thesis. Regarding the latter issue, whether Shelley or not can continue going with her hair uncovered in the homes of our parents, Rebbe said, "As I said, your position is reasonable. I am simply not convinced, but you are convinced. So I see no reason why Shelley cannot follow your view and continue doing what she had been doing up until now." Having assisted me in analyzing and formulating the varying views, but then encouraging me to paskin for myself and take responsibility for my religious decision, Rebbe had achieved his educational goal through means of the halachic process. But the story does not end there. 23 years later, my daughter Yona married Rabbi Ari Fish, an outstanding young lamdan and a wonderful human being from Yeshivat Oretzion. They too debated the issue of whether or not Yoni could go with her hair uncovered in our home and the home of Ari's parents. They agreed to call Rebbe, and whatever Rebbe would paskin would be binding on both of them. So on the first day of Chol HaMoed, Ari calls Rebbe and proceeds to present to him the Shaila. Rebbe, instead of addressing the Shaila, surprisingly asks Ari, "Why are you calling me?" rather than your own Rosh Hashiva, Rav Chaim Drukman. Ari respectfully explains that the Shaila is Yoni's Shaila, and Rebbe is the posek for the Frimer family. Rebbe says, "If the Shaila is Yoni's Shaila, why are you calling me and not Yoni?" Totally flustered, Ari hangs up the phone. A few minutes later, the phone rang again in the Lichtenstein home. This time it was Yoni calling, asking to speak with Rebbe. Yoni repeated the Shaila, and Rebbe then told her that she should cover her hair in her in-law's home, but that she could be make a lenient in our home. Yoni eagerly reported to me the entire story and conversation, leaving out absolutely no detail. The next day I called Rebbe myself, stating that I had heard from Yoni about the psak halacha he had given the previous morning. I then proceed to ask him about the proof text from the Gemara and Ksubas, not mentioning, of course, that we had discussed this very issue 25 years earlier. Nonetheless, Rebbe retorted, "I didn't agree with you 25 years ago, and I still don't agree with you." Rebbe had once again achieved his educational goal. This time, it was with the next generation. It was Yoni's Shaila, and she, not her husband, should be making the phone call. Women, no less than men, need to be engaged in the halachic process. The Gemara in Masechet Ketubot and Masechet Brachot tells a story regarding the funeral of the great Amora Rav. A group of Rav's leading Talmidim accompanied his body to the nearby town where Rav was to be buried. Upon the return from the burial, the students stopped along the riverbed in order to eat. When they finished eating, a question arose regarding the laws of Birkat HaMazon. Yet none of these great Talmidei Chachamim knew the halacha. Rav Ada bar Ahava, who had torn kriya for the Rebbe at the time of the Hespedim, tore his garment a second time. Not having Rav available to answer their shaila, simply sharpened for Rav Ahava bar Ada, the sense of terrible loss. Rashi notes that this sense of loss was due not merely to the fact that they didn't know what to paskin, but that they did not know how to paskin. Our Rebbe wanted to assure that his Talmidim would know how to paskin. I would now like to move on to an additional quality of Rebbe's psak, the humanistic quality. Rebbe was a very sensitive and humanistic posek. He always took the human factor into account. In fact, he writes in a number of places about the importance of halach psak being sensitive to the personal condition of the questioner, attributing this very quality to the psakim of Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, zichronam levracha. Moreover, in at least one place that I know of, Rebbe maintains that not under all circumstances should a posek necessarily render a formal ruling. Where there are a number of possible legitimate halachic positions, ethical, moral, and value-laden considerations may actually dictate that the posek refrain from issuing an unequivocal psak. In September 2002, a student from Yeshivat HaRetzion, Yoni Jessner, was deathly injured in a suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv. The father, Joseph Jessner, turned to Rebbe regarding the halachic permissibility of organ transplantation. It should be explained that this question necessitated Rebbe to also confront, as a precondition to organ donation, the halachic status of brain death. According to the report in the Weekend Jerusalem Post, Rebbe allowed the donation and the transplantation. I called Rebbe the following Wednesday at around 10:30 p.m. That was the usual hour that I would call Rebbe, and asked if he was prepared to discuss with me his brain death decision. Rebbe said that he was prepared to discuss the topic with me, but requested that I call him back on Motzei Shabbos. In the meantime, on Thursday night, Shelley had used a milchik karel dish to cover fleishiks in a microwave oven. Being that it was karel, compressed glass, in a microwave, which may only be bishul midrabanan, I wasn't sure whether or not the dish was treif. I told Shelley that I would ask Rebbe on Saturday night when I called to discuss with him the issue of brain death. Motzei Shabbos, after Zman Rabbeinu Tam, I called Rebbe. I would just note that Rebbe, like the Rav, kept Zman Rabbeinu Tam on Motzei Shabbos and Yontov, although he did not impose it on the rest of his family. Rebbe was well-rested and pleased to talk. I opened by saying that before we discuss brain death, I would first like to ask him a bus of a chal of Shaila. Rebbe paskin what he paskined, and we moved on to brain death. Rebbe related to me that he told Mr. Jessner from the outset that he was not going to tell him what to do, but simply present the different halachic views. Should, however, Mr. Jessner decide to view brain cessation as death, then he, Rebbe, would encourage Mr. Jessner to seriously consider in a positive fashion the option of donating Yoni's organs for transplantation in others. I asked Rebbe what would have been his view had he been required for some reason to take a position on the issue. Rebbe responded that he did not feel that he had a firm handle on the sugya. but that contrary to the ruling of the Israeli chief rabbinate, his inclination was that brain cessation was not brain death, which would preclude transplantation. I told Rebbe that with all due respect, I did not understand his approach. Although there were differing views on the issue, the Gesners had turned to Rebbe for his opinion. And if Rebbe's tendency was that brain cessation is not death, then Rebbe should have expressed his opinion. I added that he, the Rav, and my father Zatzal, Rabbi Norman Firmer, had all taught me that one needs to subject one's will to the dictates of halacha and not vice versa. Rebbe paused and then softly but firmly said to me, "Dov, do you think that life and death determinations are on par with microwave shilas?" I would like to conclude with a story that is very meaningful to me, and where Rebbe utilized the human factor as a critical consideration in his halachic decision-making. In 1992, my mother, Aleha Shalom, Esther Miriam Frimmer, was hospitalized in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital due to a massive stroke. The question arose whether or not to connect my mother to a life support system should the need arise. The doctors, Professor Yonatan Alevi and Dr. Gabriel Breuer, were generally concerned that due to the stroke, her heart might stop beating or that she would perhaps stop breathing. When they presented me with the options, I requested to speak with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein prior to making any decision. It was only then that I had learned that Dr. Breuer was a Boger, a graduate of Yeshivat Har Etzion. When we called Rebbe, Dr. Breuer reported to him that the stroke was indeed very serious, but they had not yet performed a CT scan. Dr. Breuer further expressed his professional opinion that should anything occur, my mother should not be connected to a life support system. However, were she nonetheless connected to such a system, it would extend her life for a mere 10 days to 2 weeks. Rebbe listened carefully to Dr. Breuer's description and told him that he would render a final decision only after they view the CT scan together. But in the interim, should anything occur, he requests that they do connect my mother to the life support system. In less than an hour, Rebbe arrived at the hospital, and he and Dr. Breuer viewed the CT scan together. Upon review, Dr. Breuer changed his mind and concurred with Rebbe that should the need arise, my mother should be connected to a life support machine. At that point, Rebbe went to a corner in the hospital room and proceeded to pray for her recovery. When he finished davening, I approached him and asked, "Rebbe, when Dr. Breuer initially recommended not to connect my mother to a life support system, why did you nonetheless instruct him to do so?" Rebbe responded, "First of all, Dr. Breuer indicated that the machine could extend her life for a period of 10 days to 2 weeks, and the halacha states that even limited life, chaye sha'ah, is deemed to be life. But I had a second reason," he continued. "I felt that your father could use the additional 2 weeks to come to terms with his wife's death." Stunned by his explanation, I turned to Rebbe and asked, "Is that a halacha consideration?" Rebbe looked at me in the eyes and said, "Yes, Dov, that is a halacha consideration." Ladies and gentlemen, I dare say that such sensitivity in contemporary halachic decision-making is all too lacking. Yet, that was our Rebbe. That was Moreno v'Rabbeinu, Harav Aaron, Rabbi Chil, v'Bluma Lichtenstein, Hareni Kaparat Mishkavo, Yehi Zichro Baruch, u'tehei Nishmato Tzrura v'Tzro HaChayim.
On behalf of all of us here,
I know I'd like to take this moment to thank our speakers, thank Rabbi Danny Tropper, Rabbi Dov Frimmer, and of course to Rav Moshe. I hope Rav Moshe will convey to the members of the Mishpacha, to your mother, how very much we try to make this evening a memorable one and to do right by the great legacy of your beloved father. And now I'd like to call upon Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler to chant the Kel Mole. Rabbi Adler is the Rav of the Ohel Nechama Synagogue and was a close Talmid of Rav Aaron for many, many years. When I asked Rav Moshe about reciting the Kel Mole, he said, ask Rabbi Adler. He's a good friend. And when I spoke to Rabbi Adler, he mentioned to me something, and of course nothing is quite a coincidence. He said that some 22 years ago in this very synagogue, he was asked to chant the Kel Mole for the Rav, Rav Soloveitchik. And now we call upon him to chant the Kel Mole for Rav Soloveitchik's illustrious son-in-law.
El mole rachamim shoichem b'amomim hametze menucha nechona al kanefei ashrina במעלות קדושים וטהורים כי זוהר הקיים מזהירים לנשמת מורנו רבנו הרב אהרון בן הרב יחיא שהלך לעולמו בעבור שמשפחתו ותלמידיו נודרים צדקה מיד אז גונת נשמתו מגני ידן תהיה מנוחתו לוחן מלא רחמים יסתירהו בסתר כנפיו לעולמים ויצרור החיים את נשמתו אדוני ונחלתו וינוח בשלום המשכבוי ונעימוי